It's up there.
Yeah. Well, just starting off then, in a sort of almost a sort of administrative account in a way of the yeah. origins, could you say just a little about how the various the rounds, as you call them in the book, I mean the development of these three stages in the history of the yeah. service, how these come about, and against what background they come out of?
Yes, well, the background in a sense is a double background. There's the far background, which is the services as they existed before 1939, and there's the foreground, which is the wartime circumstances in which the thing grew up. Well, now, the wartime side of it had a considerable influence, of course, on the hospital structure, as the emergency hospital scheme had created for the first time some sort of national hospital service. The general practitioner side, I think, arose out of the not so much the failures as the disadvantages, the what was seen as faults of the old national health insurance system. And the war meant that something had to be done to cater for the situation that was likely to arise when peace came. Hence the wartime planning of the service. And that's really how it started, I think. The two main things were there had to be some future worked out for the hospitals, because financially and otherwise they had been turned upside down during the war. A future had to be worked out for the general practitioners in order to have something ready for the thousands of doctors in the forces when they came home.
Would it be fair to say that in general everybody wants the state to be involved in some way or other, and the question will then become what the details are going to be? That in overall terms the various parties involved are quite happy for a state service and would see it to mutual advantage?
I think everybody wanted the state to be involved, yes. Whether they would all have accepted a state service, whatever you were implying by that, I'm not so sure. Reorganization was certainly generally accepted as essential. What exact form that should take is another matter.
Well, what's the story then about the form it actually came to take? What are the sort of crucial moments in that story?
Well, I think as usual, we're prisoners of our past, and the National Health Service, after all, evolved from what had gone before. It didn't come down from heaven, and the result is that at the time you had to find some new structure for the hospital service. That is to say, for a post-war reorganized hospital service, taking both the voluntary and the municipal hospitals into account. You had to reorganize, as far as was necessary, the general practitioner service, and you had to essentially provide something for local authorities to continue to do in the health field when once you'd taken their hospitals away from them. So that there were those three factors which resulted almost inevitably in the so-called tripartite structure that came into existence in 1948.
So that's what the tripartite, those are the three parts of the tripartite system.
Those are the three parts, yes.
Would it be invidious to ask whether any particular part of this tripartite organization had given, as it were, more power to one or other segment of the thing, or do you think it was evenly distributed? I mean, is it possible to regard, for example, the fate of the general practitioner as being less successful or have come away with less than was the case with consultants? Or was it an even distribution of authority?
An even distribution of authority? No. You see, within the tripartite structure, you've really got separate pockets of power, haven't you? You've got the Executive Council running the General Practitioner services, and within that orbit, the General Practitioner is pretty powerful. You have the hospital structure, and within the hospital structure, the consultants certainly are very powerful, not only because how the hospital operates depends almost entirely on how the consultants make it operate, but also because for the first time, consultants were brought into the administrative structure itself and took part in decision-making. I'm not sure that I can think of any other centre of power. If anybody lost out on this, I think it was the consumer.
That's interesting. How? Say more about that. I mean, how?
Well, you see, the regional hospital boards and hospital management committees, which were set up to run the hospital structure, had a few nominated consumer representatives, so-called, on them. But essentially, they were not consumer representatives in the sense in which, for example, elected local authority members are. And I think in an ideal world, I might have said that these hospital bodies ought to have been elective for that reason. In the same way, on the executive councils, although there are lay members, broadly speaking, it's the professional members who run the thing and who have the power.
And has that remained so even in the revisions that have occurred in the subsequent period? I mean, do you think the consumer interest is still underrepresented?
I do, yes. Indeed, in some ways, I think it's less represented now than it was originally. You see, if you think, again, in terms of the hospital structure, there were at least some consumer representatives on the regional hospital boards and hospital management committees. The theory of the present restructuring, as I understand it, is that there are no consumer representatives on the hospital administrative bodies now at all. The consumer, if he has a place, is in the Community Health Council. And the Community Health Council is not much more, I think, than a fig leaf to cover embarrassment.
Just on a different theme, before we come back to the sort of current, more on the current world, as it were, One thing that seems to come across from looking at the history and indeed these interviews and so on is that you could propose, in a rather odd way perhaps, that the degree to which the service is a political creation as against a contractarian agreement between a profession, its institutions and the state, i.e. the doctors, the hospitals and the state, that you could actually propose that it's not the political dimension is, as it were, relatively unimportant. That, in other words, there are simply these interests at work, and they have come to collaborate independently for a state service in whatever form, and that the amount of political rhetoric or interest group activity is, roughly speaking, a minor problem. That the degree of the role of ideology, let us say, is relatively unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one clear example way of debating this is through looking at the SMA.
Mm-hmm.
Which obviously, particularly in the 30s, has a very political tone to its membership. Would you say that the political dimension was relatively unimportant as against this bargain being struck by the various interested parties that might have gone on without it?
No, I think the political element is very important in some ways. Let me take the SMA first. The SMA undoubtedly influenced Anaren Bevan. He did not let the SMA's policies rule his actions, but it undoubtedly influenced him. And to that extent, the SMA as such had some power. You talk of these various interests getting together sort of independently and striking a bargain, but that's not really what happened. You had these various interests all fighting their own corner, and putting it very crudely, at the end of the day, somebody had to knock their heads together, and an Iron Bevan did it. So that the political element in that sense was very important.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm being sort of devil's advocate, but I mean, as you will know, Lord Hill will actually claim that, I mean, there was Bevan with his rhetoric over here and what he had to say in the House and so forth. Well, actually, he was in restaurants with Lord Moran and so on, striking the real bargain. So in that sense, the rhetoric's over here, the deal's being made over here, and in that sense, Hill wants to say that the doctors almost created the NHS on their own terms, but the terms were the details of what counted, and the fights of the mid-40s and up to the Act were about detail. Would you say that even though they were about detail, they were fairly fierce fights between the BMA and the ministry or whatever, there is quite a fierce struggle going on in 46 to 48?
So. Oh, yes, I think so, undoubtedly. I mean, unless Lord Hill would now say that was all shadow boxing on his part.
Could you say more about what the fights were? But what are the particular details that the doctors are worried about? The 100% question?
No, the 100%, the idea of 100% service, they accepted fairly early on in the process. I think the thing that really horrified them was the idea of being paid by salary, because they saw any salaried element as being the first step on a slippery slope that ended up as full-time salaried service. And that was the thing that they made most fuss about, I think. How much reality there was in it, I don't know. I never did know how much reality there was in these arguments.
Well, then, on a sort of, as it were, a final idea, do you feel, as a reflection, that there are any features to the original structure of the NHS, the tripartite one, although it had been revised, of course, but that there are any, as it were, intrinsic structural parts of its original form that contain difficulties, problems, questions of how to keep interests weighted against each other that have become more troubling. I mean, for example, our general practitioners quite clearly excluded from hospital life too much. I mean, are there faults, as it were, in the initial plan that you think have become more obvious over the succeeding years?
Well, I suppose the original defect was the tripartite nature of the structure. There again, of course, you've got to remember that if people are willing to work together, any structure, however defective, can be made to work. And there's no doubt at all that in some places the tripartite structure worked perfectly well because people at the grassroots got together and worked together, even though they might be serving different masters. But you can't get away from the fact that having a tripartite administrative structure militated against cooperation of the different branches of the service. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And to the extent that reorganisation has got over that, it's a jolly good thing.
And has it done so, do you think? I mean, is that your view of the current...
Well, not altogether, of course, because, once again, the general practitioners have insisted on continuing in England their independence, that is to say, their separate administrative structure. The others, I should have thought, were now fairly well under one hat.
And then finally, just as a sort of, I mean, as it were, the simple question, I mean, the most interesting. I mean, has it been a success, do you think? I mean, just to ask the grand question, I mean, has it been a success? And would you say that if one went around talking about crisis in the NHS, which almost becomes a permanent description of the service, it's permanently in crisis, that it has been successful within the limits of things in the world, and that the idea of it being permanently in crisis is a political exaggeration?
Well, that would be my assessment, yes. Of course, I'm not a very good person to ask, because I'm identified with the NHS, you see, have been for about 40 years. And so that I think it has been a success. I certainly think if you look at almost any of the advanced countries, you'll find that we've got a better health service in Ilm. And so that, to that extent, I think it's been a success. Don't know if I can say any more than that.
Is it underfinanced?
I mean, well, underfinanced. There again, I mean, the difficulty there surely is that you can never have enough money for the health service. And when you get down to brass tacks, what you have to do is to say, this is the proportion of the national income we are prepared to spend on the health service. Now go away and do your best you can with that. Mm. You can never hope to have as much money as everybody would want to run the perfect health service.
But to take, I mean, just out of the hat, but I mean, there's obviously one argument that people come up with, which is, well, you're paying a lot of money to private drug companies. I mean, the bill there is obviously extremely large, and the socialist case would remain, as it were, that if you nationalised those particular concerns, then part of the bill being footed by the NHS and the taxpayer would be reduced or, as it were, disappear. I mean, is that just a sort of political wishful thinking, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know whether that's true or not. I mean, whether it would in fact be substantially reduced. All I do know is that it's a very small proportion of the expenditure of the National Health Service.
Thank you. That's very good. Thank you very much. Well, I mean, it's very... doing these interviews has actually been interesting. I mean, mainly because of the amount of consensus everyone seems to feel that the origin of the service was rather agreeable, slightly uncontroversial even. Could you say something about your sense of the background to the period of the 40s? I mean, did you, as a doctor, just in your own experience, what sort of things were felt would improve with the national health?
I'm sorry, you said 40s, that was during the war.
Yeah.
Well, there was a rather artificial then. We were preoccupied with other things. Before the war, in the 30s?
Well, starting with the war, it seems that the emergency medical service did actually, particularly in relations between the voluntary hospitals and the local authority hospitals, produce the beginnings of collaboration between those two things, for example, that the war did have a kind of...
Oh, yes, it had
to. Could you say a bit about the war as an effect on the medical services?
Well, I wasn't in the hospital service, you see. I was in general practice. but they were all brought into one service, which was an advantage in itself. And, of course, with London, we had the sectors, the hospital in the inner zone, the intermediate hospital, and then the further out hospital. The idea being, of course, that air raids would destroy a large part of London, but still something had to be kept there. But the majority of patients moved out a safe distance.
Was the war important in the... To be very simple, was the war important in the history of the origins of the NHS, do you think? I mean, did it give people a sense of what could be done on new lines?
Yes, well, it did show that there could be cooperation, but I don't think really that the war was needed to show that. It pushed people into it, but it produced a different sorts of atmosphere. The First War did the same thing. Lloyd George spoke of homes fit to heroes to live in. Then became, oh, we can't afford it, financial crisis, get his act. Then we had the same feeling in the Second War. We were all together in fighting. We must be all together in peacetime afterwards. And that lasted. That was the difference. I think it was far more in the spirit of cooperation which it produced than in the practical measures. And those, of course, these did help.
Well, then moving then to the later, the sort of the actual story of the origins itself. It seems more and more striking that the origins of this extraordinary and, you know, in some sense rather magnificent idea wasn't one that came through violent conflict between the state, the various doctoral interests, the unions, whatever. It seems in many ways to have been peculiarly uncontroversial. Now, I know that there are BMA rows and so on. There were details which I hope we'll talk about, but would you say that that was that's in a general sense the correct account, that in fact most people were quite anxious to see a proper state service? The questions would be over details.
Yes, I think a national service would be a better expression than a state service. Yes, broadly there wasn't much difference over aim. There was a good deal of difference over the best route to reach it.
And what was that? What was, in your memory, what were those details and struggles about?
Whether you should have a voluntary cooperation or whether you should have a state-run enterprise ordered from the top. Those were the big things. From our point of view, of course, the question was whether family doctors should be state salaried service servants or remain as the patient's individual family doctor.
And that was something, was that something particularly that general practitioners would be concerned about? I mean, that's a particular feeling that they must have had.
Oh, but it was general practitioners only. You see, the relationship between a family doctor and his patient is completely different from the relationship between any other doctor. A consultant sees a patient, perhaps sees him two or three times, exceptionally sees him over longer periods, but then his relationship stops. Now the family doctor normally would expect to have the patient as long as both patient and doctor are in the same area.
So what was the settlement, just in terms of the story, what was the settlement in the end? How was this impulse about family doctors not losing that special relationship actually built in to the Act?
That relationship was in essence preserved. The doctor was not to be paid a fixed salary by the state. He was to be paid a capitation fee. That is to say, each patient who came to him was, so to speak, his employer. And if the patient ceased to employ him, that affected his income. But he was employed by the patients and not by the state. Though, of course, there were certain restrictions. But in the end, not very many.
Would you say that in terms of the what we're calling the doctors in rather sort of loose way, that any particular branch of the profession could be said to have had more power within the tripartite structure than others? I mean, it's said, for example, that slowly over the succeeding years, general practitioners have been not excluded from the hospital world, but they are too far away from it in some way. And this is the Honigsbaum view, as it were, the division in medicine. Did the NHS in its original construction give particular power to any particular part of the profession?
I wouldn't say that it was a case of giving power. there was a redistribution. before the war, in many parts of the country, this may have been one, though I don't know, I wasn't here, In many parts of the country, the hospital surgeons, for example, were also engaged in general practice. And that was, in fact, the only way in which you could get surgeons at the hospital, the provincial hospitals in many places. But it wasn't as good as it might be, because engaged in two separate branches at once doesn't, in my opinion, help you to keep up to the top rank in either. Well, now the surgeons are all consultants, and none of them are engaged in general practice. And I think it is better. Honigsbaum thinks it's a mistake. Well, for communication, of course, it is unfortunate if anything interferes with that. But for a separation of functions, it is very much better. It is just ordinary, simple specialization. One man in the hospital, one man in general practice, and they both need to be specialized.
So, I mean, it's asking a lot in a very short sort of question, but from your own times within the negotiations and then subsequently, would you generally say that the service didn't embody any unsatisfactory structural feature at the beginning, that roughly speaking it was okay and it's stayed okay, in fact even slightly improved in general? The division, what's called the division and thought of as a bad thing by certain writers, i.e. Honigsbaum, is actually for the best. And then in that sense, there's no structural fault in the structure of the service resulting from its origins. It has a kind of soundness that you still feel is real.
Well, there was too much separation between the branches of the service. You had the hospital service, the family practitioner service. It's wider than doctors, of course, includes dentists and chemists. And then, up till 1974, you had the local authority services. They weren't brought close enough together. The 1974 reorganization set out to do that, but unfortunately, it was just handed over to the bureaucrats, who did it in the most appalling bureaucratic manner. the aim was right, but the method of doing it was ridiculous.
Looking then finally at the current situation, which I mean one could just have a few reflections on.
Yes.
People talk, well, there are two sort of things that seem to come up. People talk a lot about crisis, the crisis in the NHS. It seems almost a sort of stand way of speaking. Do you think that's an exaggeration in the 70s and 80s? Or have things changed in some particular way since the 40s for the worse? Or how do you feel about how it is, what the shape is?
I think it is an exaggeration. But then I think when the word crisis is used, generally it is. The media use crisis periodically and frequently, and it happens rarely. No, the service is evolving, and of course, under present financial conditions, it's difficult for the service as well as for anything else. But I do not see any crisis. There is always the possibility of one arising.
And do you think that in general, doctors as a profession feel the commitment to socialized medicine or national health or whatever one wants to properly call it with the same kind of zeal and almost sort of ethical enthusiasm that they did at the period of its inception?
No, I think Perhaps not, because at the period of its inception, as with many other things, hopes were raised too high. But I would say that as far as I am in a position to observe, doctors are broadly satisfied with the service at present. Not in detail, certainly. They'll all tell you there are many things which could be improved and should be improved. But as between National Health Service and no National Health Service, I don't think there would be the slightest doubt that an overwhelming response in favour of the service.
And just to go backtrack to finish off,
yes.
On Bevan, would you concur with what everyone seems to say about him, that his essential characteristic was that he could...